This is an ABC podcast.
There's a coroner's court in each state in Australia, and that's the court that investigates how people meet their deaths, if the circumstances are unclear or suspicious. In New South Wales, the state coroner's court publishes their reports on their website. I had a look at some of these reports, and I have to say they're just completely fascinating. I think I was expecting a bunch of dry legal documents, but instead, I found that each report begins with a short biography of the deceased person that's written in a really warm and humane way. And there's a description of how each person died, and it's very compelling. Quite often, I found that the person would have been having a perfectly normal day. Then something very quickly goes wrong, and that's that. Hugh Dillon is a former Deputy State Coroner of New South Wales, and he was presided over countless cases where the death comes about due to some momentary, terrible misstep or through a series of blunders. And then sometimes the death is fully intentional. Ultimately, the coroner has to arrive at something that's as close to the truth as possible. Hello, Hugh. Welcome.
Thank you, Richard.
I was surprised by how engrossed I was in reading some of these court reports. I think I lost an hour when I should really have been working in reading these reports. They're like an episode of Six Feet Under. I was reading one report about a truckie who died. A police officer pulled him over because the load wasn't strapped down properly. There was an angry exchange. He yanked down on the load. It spilled onto him. He fell onto the road and got run over. Just like that. I wonder when you're dealing with cases like all that at that time, do you get a bit jumpy?
Well, certainly the first year I was a coroner, I became very hypervigilant, I think, as a result of reading reports of deaths like this. It can make you very, very sensitive to the contingency of life.
Yeah, does life feel a bit precious, I suppose?
Oh, yeah, every life is precious. And when you see so many of these cases, you realise that these sort of events can happen to anybody.
Yeah, like a girder falling out of off a crane or something on top of you.
Absolutely, and there's no guarding against it really, except through building better systems and so on and so on.
So, when someone dies, why might that person's death be referred to a coroner's court?
Well, coroners investigate sudden, unexpected, accidental, or violent deaths, but they also have referred to them deaths which are not diagnosed by doctors. So, for example, if a doctor won't issue a medical death certificate saying that this person died naturally, then the case is referred to the coroners for diagnosis of the cause of death.
So, in other words, if someone dies from having a piano dropped on them, the doctor would say, well, a violent blow was the reason for death, but a coroner has to look at the circumstances of that.
That's right. That's right.
And can the family of a deceased person request a coronial inquest?
Certainly. And in fact, many, many inquests are the result of being of requests or prompts from the family. Some inquests are mandatory, such as suspected homicides and those sort of things. But many discretionary cases, such as medical inquests, are requested by families.
So who gives you this report? Is that the police that come to you with a report of a death that the circumstances are unclear?
Yeah, generally the police provide the report, and that will be as a result of them attending a hospital or something like that, or an accident scene.
Do you have to put the funeral on hold in that case?
It can sometimes lead to funerals being delayed, yes. Yeah, because there has to be a medical investigation done first. So to determine what the cause of death is or how that death came about may take a little time anyway.
What are the questions you're really asking when you start an inquiry like that?
Well, the first question you ask is who died. So we need to identify, if we possibly can, who died. And the Coroner's Act requires that, and it also requires that we look at where the death occurred, and that's not always clear, when it occurred, again, not always clear. And then we have to look at the question of cause of death, which really means the physiological or medical cause. And finally, we're required to look at what is called the manner of death, which relates to the question of the circumstances. How did this death come about? Those are the big questions.
If you can't get past that first stage of identifying who it is that's died, the identity of that person, do you proceed anyway?
Yes, of course. It's important to do that because whoever it is that we have before us, we need to explore further how that person died. A good example of this is a case I did a few years ago. The body of a little baby, a newborn baby, was found on Maroubra Beach, and she's been named Lily Grace. She's buried over in the Eastern Suburbs Cemetery, but we still don't know who she is. But someday I hope that someone will come forward and identify her. But we had to identify, if we could, who she was, but we then explored all the other circumstances that we could find evidence for.
So you're in this kind of environment of uncertainty and you're just trying to sort of, I don't know, was it bringing or a foggy picture that you're trying to bring into resolution then?
Yeah, in some cases, in many cases, the case is very clear and we have those, we have witnesses, we have, for example, photographs, we have evidence which tells you all about it. And so, for example, the case that you referred to at the start of our conversation of the very unfortunate truck driver being killed, that would have been a very clear-cut case to investigate, I would have thought.
When you've had the investigation, is that then followed always by an inquest?
No, and that can be a problem. A lot of the deaths reported to coroners in New South Wales and indeed elsewhere in Australia are natural deaths for which a doctor has not provided a diagnostic medical cause of death certificate. So in Victoria, for example, I think 40% of deaths are reported, are diagnosed as being natural. In New South Wales, I imagine it's roughly the same.
40%, mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, natural death, right.
Yeah. But the rest are accidents or medical accidents or drug overdoses or all sorts of other things, suicides. These are big categories.
And when do you then make the decision to proceed to having a proper inquest?
What we first do is get the medical cause of death established, and that's done by a medical investigation by a forensic pathologist, and that can be done in various ways. After we get the pathologist's report, I'm sorry, I should have also said that at the same time we ask for the pathologist's report, we ask for a police report, which may be more or less detailed depending on the circumstances of the case as we know it at that stage. So we'll get the police report and the medical report and analyse all of that. And in some cases, an inquest is required by law. So I think I said suspected homicides, if a person is missing and suspected of dying, and if a person dies in police operations or if a person dies in custody, we're required to hold an inquest in New South Wales.
And when you do that, who might be present for an inquest like that?
Usually the family or family members are present. And depending on the case itself, there will always be in the courtroom, the coroner, of course, we would have a counsel assisting or an advocate assisting us. In a more complex inquest, we would have solicitors from the Crown Solicitor's Office. We would have a police investigator, at least one police investigator. We may have medical experts. We may have other witnesses. And then, of course, the family are there too. Plus representatives of, for example, if a death concerns police, the police officers and the police commissioner would be represented and hospitals and so on and so on.
So it's like a commission of inquiry, a royal commission or something on a smaller scale.
Yeah.
It's not a trial as such.
It's not a trial, no. It is an inquiry, which means a search for the truth. And we talk about the inquisitorial method rather than the adversarial method. So we're really trying to answer the five questions I talked about, and ultimately we're trying to find lessons to prevent future deaths as well.
Can people be required to give evidence to a coroner's court?
Yeah, they can. And so we can compel witnesses to come to court and give evidence. And even if they're, for example, with the phrase of term of art is a person of interest, a person who is in fact a suspect in a suspected homicide, they can be compelled to give evidence. They will be protected by coroner giving them a certificate so that their evidence can't be used against them in a criminal court or elsewhere. But we can, yes, compel people.
Can you have people arrested? Order police to arrest people? And do you have powers of subpoena and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's rarely done. But if witnesses refuse to come to court, ultimately they can be arrested and brought.
And if they tell lies while they're giving evidence, is that considered perjury?
I'm sure it is considered perjury. I've never referred somebody, or I've rarely, I think, in many years, referred somebody to the authorities to be prosecuted for perjury. It's usually suspect that someone's not telling the truth, but it would be hard to establish beyond a reasonable doubt.
And when you do, when you've got a witness who's telling a story that just seems like, you know, a shocking bit of fabrication, do you step in at that point and you go, now come on? Do you, or does a lawyer do that?
Counsel assisting or one of the other lawyers involved in the case might cross-examine them about that. On occasion, I have, used my authority to press them for the truth. One case I had concerned a fire in a panel beating shop. I believe the panel beating shop was burned down for insurance purposes, and there were two or three people who gave evidence, one of whom was a very, I know this will sound unkind, but he was a very uneducated and I thought rather stupid person who had not been worded up very well by his mates, and he got really confused telling the story, and when he was pressed on that, he just couldn't do it anymore, and he shut up.
Oh.
And I told him he had to answer the questions, and if he didn't, then I'd have to think about citing him or referring him to be prosecuted for contempt. He thought about that overnight, and in my opinion anyway, he came back having been worded up again by his mates and
forceful exchange of views overnight,
yeah,
right?
Yes, I'm sure there was an exchange of views. Right. And anyway, he came back and he told what sounded to me like a pack of nonsense. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I quickly dismissed him after that.
Is there a jury present for the workings of a coronial inquest?
No. In the UK and Canada, they have juries. But in New South Wales, the last jury, I think, was in 2008, the Jake Kovco case. That was the case of the soldier who shot himself accidentally in Iraq back in 2003, I think that happened. So that's the last time we've had a jury sit in a coroner's case in New South Wales, and I think they've been abolished in other states and territories.
What would the jury determine? Why would you need a jury there?
Well, some people will argue that juries are very good because they're democratic. They represent the community. And so they don't bring the prejudices, I guess, that it might be thought people who work closely with the police, like coroners, sometimes do. So
would the jury, if there was one, make a finding about the cause of death?
That's right. Yeah, they would make findings about the five questions that I've already explained: identity, date and place, manner and cause of death.
So if you're holding an inquest, and then pretty compelling evidence starts to emerge that someone is about to be strongly implicated for manslaughter or murder, what would happen at that point? And what would you do as the coroner then?
Yeah. Well, if we get to a point when we're persuaded that there's enough evidence for a case to go to trial, generally we would stop the case there and refer the papers to the DPP. We're not allowed to say we think someone, you know, so-and-so, Richard Fadler, has murdered such-and-such.
Well, I'd hope you wouldn't think that or indeed say that.
No. But what we are allowed to say is that, in our opinion, a known person has... there is evidence that a known person may have committed an indictable offence, namely murder or manslaughter, which resulted in a death, and that the inquest will stop there and the DPP will consider it.
So why are you using careful language there? Are you trying to avoid prejudice in your judgment there?
That's exactly right, yeah.
But don't people want you to give your opinion in such cases?
Oh, look, I'm sure a lot of people do, but there's a question of fairness and prejudice. Mm. Going back about 30 years, there are a number of court cases in which coroners actually used to say things like, I believe so-and-so did such-and-such, and it led to amendment of the Act to prevent this.
Well, that would be overstepping the mark, wouldn't it? Or, I mean, but you wouldn't say even that, I believe it's possible that such-and-such is...
Yeah. No, you won't say that. Mm. There's enormous reputational damage that can be done, of course, as well as prejudice to a fair trial. So we have to be quite careful about that.
How does someone become a coroner? How does that happen?
I became a coroner by accident, really.
By accident.
I was a magistrate for 12 years at that point, and I more or less got to a stage in my career where I was feeling burned out. I was thinking about leaving and going to the bar. And my friend Mary Jerram, who was the newly appointed state coroner, heard about my plan to leave, and she asked me whether I'd like to come and work with her. And I really liked Mary, and I thought, oh, well, it's probably pretty depressing work, but because I like her and I didn't have other plans, I thought I would. And on the first day of my appointment, I was in my office, new office, and a barrister friend rang me up and said, mate, you've just been appointed to the most interesting jurisdiction in New South Wales, and it is.
Yeah, that seems to mirror my experience with looking into, you know, the reports themselves. You think, this is going to be dry and grim and horrible. But actually, there's all of human life in these stories, isn't there?
Yeah, there's all of human life, and the great privilege of being a coroner, I think, is that you get to sit in courtrooms or read letters and in a way meet people who have died, but also the people who mourn them, who love them. And the great incentive for a coroner to do a good job is to try and relieve the burden of sadness, to provide some meaning for these deaths, because what bereaved people really want out of a case, I think, is respect for the person who's died, respect for them and their concerns and their burning questions, but also, if possible, that a death like this can be avoided in future.
Yeah. So that burning question of why, how did such a thing happen? How could this have happened? That's what your job is, I suppose.
Yes. And if we can answer the question why and how, then we may be able to provide suggestions for prevention.
Hugh, here's a really embarrassing admission here. I've discovered I thought, and a lot of people around me thought, that you needed some kind of medical qualification to be a coroner, that you were somehow involved in the autopsy, which that's not true, is it, as it turns out?
No, well, coroners in Australia are lawyers, but it certainly helps to have medical knowledge insofar as learning the medicine and getting involved in autopsies and so forth. It is possible, and it became possible for me to learn a lot of medicine and, in fact, observe autopsies.
What, aside from the legal knowledge, what are the main tools of your work?
Well, I think the main tool, frankly, is the input that you get from families, the input you get from police investigators, the input you get from experts such as forensic pathologists, but also we call on all sorts of experts. But I think that the real tool that good coroners have is intellectual curiosity, their own intellectual curiosity, and the desire to if possible, prevent future deaths. So I think those are the real tools of this.
How about some sort of insight into human nature too? I mean, you know, human nature's got to be a large part of...
Of course it is. And this is a real school of human nature. I mean, you get to hear stories and meet people who have incredible and extraordinary stories to tell you. And I've met lots of Aboriginal people. I've met people from all sorts of different cultures. I've met people who do all sorts of extraordinary things. So, but all of them have very human reactions to these deaths, which is comforting, really. I've met very few callous or sociopathic people in this job.
I suppose you're just dealing with mess a lot of the time, really, then. Some awful mishap or a series of mishaps that...
Yeah, a lot of it is very messy, unfortunately, and in many cases you can't do much about that. But I think the key is remaining hopeful that out of all of these terrible events, some good things can come, even if it's only a show of respect to the people who've lost somebody. I think one of the very important things about the coronial system is that it is the state, the community, paying respect to individual people who have died and their very bereaved families.
What if there's a situation, I'm sure this happens not irregularly, where you suspect there may have been some, I don't know if you use this term anymore, wrongful death here or something like that, and you really do need to order that an autopsy be performed on someone, and the family objects strongly to this, that you have to override the wishes of the family in this
matter. Yeah, this is difficult, of course. And one of the good things at Glebe, and I believe in other coronial systems too, we have a very good team of liaison officers, family, their counsellors, their psychologists, who are very skilled at talking people through these difficult problems. There are groups, and they don't even have to have religious belief, but some religious groups, such as Muslims and Jews and others, have a cultural and religious objection to dissection of the body. They want to bury their loved ones whole. Mm. But sometimes, for example, in a murder case or a homicide case, it is necessary to conduct an autopsy. And by and large, people get that. And they get it because they're treated respectfully and sensitively.
Will you talk to the family? And will you do it from the bench or also away from the bench?
I wouldn't generally talk to families before the case if we're going to hold an inquest. I would sometimes talk to families if we're not holding an inquest, because they want to know things and we can explain it without holding an inquest or something like that. Certainly in court, in the inquest, I talk directly, and I think most coroners do talk directly to family members. The very first thing you do once you've taken appearances from the lawyers sitting at the bar table is speak directly to the family and welcome them and acknowledge them and give them an explanation of what we're trying to do, but also acknowledge their distress and their hopes that we'll find something out for
them. That's a pro forma thing. You will do that. Just as a matter of course, welcome the family and speak for them. Speak to them respectfully and kindly.
Yeah, and it's a really necessary thing to do, but they are the central people. They're the most important people in the courtroom, so you have to acknowledge them. But it's the human thing to do anyway.
Yeah, like I say, in the report, one of the other things that really struck me is this kind of very nice biography that's often written about the deceased person. Is that an innovation, or has that been going on since the year dot to write a short biography that's not written like a policeman at the scene of a crime, but it's written by someone, it's not gushy or anything, but it's just written in a kind of a humane way?
Yeah, I don't know. I certainly think it has changed over the last decade in New South Wales. The coroner's reports that I used to read when I was a younger lawyer and so forth were two or three pages of pretty dry stuff without much human material in there. I learned from Michael Barnes, who is the penultimate state coroner, that he did this in Queensland, and this is something I learned when I was a new coroner, and so I started adopting it. And I think it's a common practice anywhere here.
What kind of atmosphere do you have in the courtroom? Is it one of those kind of antique rooms with, you know, wainscoting on the walls, judge sitting on the high bench? Do you work in a humane environment?
Look, it could be much more egalitarian. The bench is high. It looks like a fairly typical criminal courtroom or civil courtroom. I'm sure if we turned our minds to it, we could redesign a courtroom that would be more humanly encouraging.
And when family members do come in, what state of mind do they tend to be in?
Well, in different states of mind. Some people are very angry. I've had some people get very angry and agitated in courtrooms. Most people, though, I think, come hopefully and respectfully and place an enormous amount of trust in you.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler.
So once you've sort of got to the bottom here of some death by a whole bunch of mishaps, for example, you release recommendations, won't you? What kind of weight do these recommendations carry with government agencies and the like that you want to reread these recommendations?
I'd really like to know that because it's hard to work out. Some agencies are very responsive and thoughtful and in fact come to an inquest thinking about recommendations that might arise out of this. You know, a good example of this is the Fire Service, Fire and Rescue New South Wales. Others, I think, are a bit more defensive and more guarded in their response. It is difficult sometimes, I think, for some agencies like the police to accept criticism.
Just about every state bureaucracy is going to put up the drawbridge, I think, most of the time. Or depends how you put these things to them, I suppose. But by and large, they tend to be very guarded about any kind of criticism.
Some more than others. And I think that rather depends on who's running those agencies.
So do you have the power to compel, in a way? Or you don't, I suppose you do. Do you, to compel that recommendations be adopted? Or do you bring them to ministers? What happens
there? We send them to ministers. We don't have a power to compel. And frankly, although some people might think it would be a good idea to compel agencies to adopt recommendations, I think that's a bad idea. And the reason is because, frankly, not all recommendations are very wonderful. Some of them are, I've even seen some rather poorly judged and very impractical recommendations made. So you've got to, robust recommendations have to be well thought through, and the better thought through they are, the more likely they're to be accepted.
How about in fire-related cases? Like there was a fire you looked into in Quakers Hill in New South Wales where you had recommendations. And what have you seen there with those kinds of recommendations being adopted?
Well, the first thing about that is that was a terrible case in which 14 people died, and most of those lives would have been saved, or the deaths prevented, if there had been sprinklers installed in the nursing home, which burned down. The New South Wales government, to its very great credit, following that fire, immediately ordered that sprinklers be installed in similar sorts of facilities all over the state. So it wasn't necessary for me to recommend that sprinklers be installed in nursing homes and like facilities. But I did make a number of recommendations. I've forgotten quite how many, but it was about a dozen, I think, relating to various things to do with how APRA is the body that regulates health practitioners. And you may recall that the person who started the fire was a drug addicted nurse. So how health practitioners are managed and regulated, I made some recommendations about that. and various other things of that sort of nature, how the fire service might improve their technology and whatnot.
Is the recommendations part of your report a big thing for the families of the deceased?
It's a tremendously big thing because, as I think I was saying earlier on, what families hope will come out of this terrible event that has devastated them is that their experience won't be repeated for others or by others.
You tell me about the case of an 8-year-old boy called Israelu Pelli, whose death was reported to the coroner. Tell me about that case.
Yeah, Israelu Pelle was an 8-year-old boy who died in, I think, 2007. And it was a very, very difficult experience for his parents because he contracted bacterial meningitis. He became lethargic and he was taken first to a GP who initially thought he probably was suffering from some sort of viral thing, possibly even food poisoning, something like that. And he was given the usual treatment. The problem for the doctors, and there were six of them over the next week who saw him and failed to diagnose his condition, was that he didn't have all the usual signs of meningitis, such as spots or a rash or those sorts of things. So it looked, at least according to the confounding signs, very ambiguous, but it could have been a cold or a flu or something of that nature. But what was disturbing about this case was that he was taken to two hospitals, as well as seeing his GP a number of times. And all the way along, what was not recognised was that this boy was deteriorating and getting very, very sick. And that wasn't recognised really until the last day or so in his life. So we held an inquest, and one of the interesting things that I thought arose out of it, well, there are a number of interesting things, but one of the things that was very illuminating for me was some work we did on the difficulty of diagnosis. And diagnosis is an art, of course there's a scientific basis, but it's also an art. And it is difficult when signs and symptoms are ambiguous to necessarily to diagnose the actual cause of the illness. That doesn't really matter, though, in many cases, because what is important to recognise is when a patient is deteriorating and crashing. Because whatever you do, whatever the real disease is, you've got to deal with that. You've got to deal with their deterioration.
And so because the fact that he was being taken to different doctors at different emergency units and a different GP, that just wasn't observed then, his deterioration in this case.
Well, it wasn't being picked up. And one of the disturbing things about this was that lots of doctors, of course, in emergency departments and even GPs, busy GPs practices, are very busy and they're seeing large numbers of patients and so on and so forth. But if they don't get a real history, if they don't see the timeline, they just see what they see then and there. And what was so sad for this family, really, I think, was that they felt they were being ignored until they got to their GP again towards the end of the week. They felt they were being brushed off. But we all know that the parents know their children better than anybody else.
Yeah, they watch them like hawks. You know, that's what happens. You know, they'll have had the closest and most sustained, if not the best informed, but nonetheless the closest and most sustained observation of their kid.
That's correct. And that's even a principle of public health. It's taught to doctors. Listen to the mother. Listen to the parents. And the parents felt that they were not being listened to until they got to the last base.
Just putting that case to one side, whether this is an example of this or not, I don't know. But often in the past, in radio, we're often talking about situations where we have emergency health workers, doctors and nurses and the like, working, particularly trainee ones, working insane hours, insane stretches of time. I just wonder how often, as a coroner, you have to sort of look at the situation where some horribly exhausted poor medico has made a misdiagnosis, has made, due to sheer exhaustion, has exercised poor judgment in these cases.
Yeah, I, we do have to quite a lot. And in fact, I did quite a lot of medical cases myself, medical inquests, and examined a lot more medical cases that didn't go to inquest. And I really feel for these people. It's a shattering event for them. And as I've just explained in relation to Israelu, very often the signs and symptoms are ambiguous or confounding. And we're all, under pressure, you're looking for patterns, of course. There must be a lot of mistakes made that don't result in deaths or even serious illness. What we do know is that for every near miss, for every critical incident, say a death or a serious mishap, there's a pyramid that develops under that of cases caught just in time and so on and so forth.
Proper successful diagnosis, correct treatment, someone goes home, it's not dramatic, someone gets better and that's fine.
A lot of near misses though.
Yeah. How about, you mentioned police sometimes can get their backs up when you have a recommendation. How about the medical profession? Do they tend to receive recommendations from you as a person who's not a doctor but nonetheless who's got some insight into this? Do they tend to take these recommendations from coroners well?
They do actually. My experience with New South Wales Health and medical practitioners generally has been a very different one from the way the police approach inquests. That's not to be... I mean, the police are not a monolith. Some police are much more open-minded and indeed careful and compassionate towards families who have lost someone in a police operation and so on and so forth. But generally speaking, I think medical practitioners, perhaps because they belong to a caring profession, are more open to what might be seen as some form of correction than security forces.
Often when you're holding an inquest, if the person's been dead for quite some time, then the evidence, I suppose, the quality of evidence deteriorates over time. There's a case study here of a woman named Joyce Germain and from 2008. What can you tell me about her case?
Well, Joyce Germain's death is the most mysterious death that I dealt with in 9 years as a coroner. She was an American woman who came out to Australia in the early 80s. Some rumour that she might have been an actor. But anyway, she came out here. She developed mental health problems. She lived quietly and peacefully in Darlinghurst or Surry Hills. And about a week after her death, because the mental health team that she was working with hadn't seen her for a week or so, were concerned about her, the police broke into her flat and found her dead.
And what state was she in when they found her?
Well, in a very strange state. At first glance, you would probably think that she'd died violently. Her clothing was in disarray. There was a strange hard hat on her stomach.
A hard hat?
A hard hat, a construction worker's hard hat. There was a cord of an iron around her neck. And there were various things in her bathroom and laundry which were out of place. And the place looked as though it had been ransacked.
Had anything been stolen from the place?
Well, it's hard to know, but it didn't appear so.
Right.
There was money found in the flat.
So it seems unlikely robbery was a motive or... Well, you don't know, I suppose,
do you? We don't know. Right. We really don't know.
So she's found lying on the floor and she's got clothes strewn about.
Yeah.
Dress pulled up to her neck, hard hat on her body.
Yes.
A cord around her neck.
Yeah.
That's right. So what do you do with that?
Well, first of all, what did happen was that a forensic pathologist went from Glebe with the police investigators and the forensic experts, forensic investigators, and searched for, tried to find clues as to the cause of death. That's the first thing. She had... It turned out very superficial injuries. The cord round her neck had not inflicted a fatal injury.
Oh, really? Right.
No. Yeah.
So she hadn't been hanged
then. She had not been hanged and she hadn't been strangled. There was no evidence of that, no physical evidence of it.
Could they pinpoint a point cause, a medical cause of death?
No. So the pathologist came up with three hypotheses. I can't remember them all, but I mean, it looks on the face of it that she may well have died what we would call a natural death. But how she got into this situation with this amazing state of disarray is hard to know. One of the curious features of this case is that in the building that she lived in, there were a number of people who used and sold drugs. And one of the people who became a person of interest, I won't name him, but he was a young gay ice addict who came from a Muslim background, and he was he was the person who, it ultimately turned out, had probably first found her dead.
He hadn't rung police.
He didn't ring police because at the time he was on an ice binge, and he presumably didn't want to speak to them in that state. He also probably figured out that being found with a dead body in her flat was likely to raise suspicions against
him. In that state that he was in. Yes,
yeah, exactly. So in any event, we for quite a while, the police and indeed I were very suspicious of him, but I ultimately came to a view that it was unlikely that he had harmed her. I think what happened was that she had somehow or other maybe died naturally or something had happened. Maybe she had even died of fright. I don't know. But that he had come into her flat, possibly in the company of others, and then been surprised. He had been in her flat sometime before with a few others who were taking drugs when she was not there. Somebody had access to her flat. And then he says that he got into her flat because he found the door open.
And saw this ghastly scene.
Yeah, he walked in and found it.
And the fact that she hadn't been found for a week, was that one reason why it was so hard to establish medically the cause of death?
Yes, because one of the things that can happen in when a body starts to deteriorate is that some of the signs of violence disappear. So, for example, if you are smothered, little pinpoint hemorrhages occur in the whites of your eyes. They're called petechial hemorrhages. So it's possible that she was smothered without having been actually strangled. But we don't know that. That's just speculation.
Was the guy thought that the nature of the circumstances in which he was found had something ritualistic about it? I mean, it sounds like it to me.
It's pretty weird. One of the most strange aspects of this was that this young gay guy, when he was taking ice, when he was on an ice binge, used to shave part of his head with a razor. And he had also, when he was on an ice binge, he was also known to wear a hard hat. And his DNA was found on this hard hat. So it may have been, he denied that the hard hat was his, but it may have been, who knows. Joyce Germain's body was also found with part of her pubic hair shaved, which is one of the weirdest things that I've ever heard of. Now, this young fellow had never seen a naked woman. He was not sexually interested in women, and he came from a very strict Muslim background. So he was very respectful of women, but who knows what people can do when they're on ice.
So what happens when you can't establish cause and circumstances of death like that?
Well, we hold an inquest in the hope that the publicity might generate some evidence. And in fact, we publicised the holding of this inquest, but unfortunately nothing emerged that we didn't already know.
How likely is it the mystery of her death will ever be solved?
Look, personally, I think it's unlikely, unless someone who was there when she got the cord round her neck emerges, and I doubt that that's going to happen. I don't think we'll ever know. I think that's a shame.
Hugh, when was the first time you came into contact with a coroner? Was it around a parent's death?
Yes. My father died in December 1983. which came, as you can imagine, as an incredible shock to the family. He died at sea off the Western Australian coast. He was then working for the BHP fleet in their ore carriers. So when he was found dead, the ship pulled into Fremantle and his body was taken ashore and an autopsy was conducted. That's the first time. So I remember how very bewildering and confusing and indeed shocking his death was to us. It turned out to be a natural death, but the whole scenario, just not knowing how he died, was very shocking. So I have a strong sense of what people confronting the experience of a coronial death might feel like.
How different was that process then to how you might run a coronial process now?
It was pretty straightforward. We got a letter from the coroner not long afterwards saying, so sorry for the loss you've suffered. The cause of death was heart issues, and that was it. There was an autopsy done and there was no inquest. So I think these days there would be much more investigation done. There was no police report as far as I'm aware. We would certainly do a police report in a similar case, or get a police investigation done, I should say.
You left the coroner's court a couple of years ago. What made you want to leave? Did you want to leave or what happened?
I didn't really want to leave. I was really told that I was told by the chief magistrate, in effect, that my time was up. I'd been there for nearly 9 years. At the time he told me, I'd been there for about 8 years. And coroners are part of the local court of New South Wales. So he was indicating that it's time for somebody else to have a go.
Really? So it's you're on a circuit then, are you, of a kind? Really? So you don't – I just imagine you'd just get – it'd be like the DPP or something like that. I don't know. You'd get appointed to that position. You'd stay there till you wanted to go.
Yeah, well, I wish that were the case, and I would have loved to have stayed. I think I had a lot more to contribute, but anyway, that's the way the system operates.
Right. And so then you just, what did you want to do after that then, if you couldn't stay?
I wasn't entirely sure. In fact, I spent the year writing a book, not about coroners, but the Second World War, an aspect of the Second World War. And now I've started a PhD on the coronial system in New South Wales. So I'm very happy to be involved in the system again.
Are the coronial systems standardised between the state governments?
Sadly not, no. Victoria has the best system.
Why is there the best?
The great thing about the Victorian system is it's a specialist court. It's a standalone specialist court. People aren't shuffled in and out by the magistrates, by the chief magistrate. And secondly, and this is the most important thing, they have a dedicated research unit whose specific task is to try to work out ways. They're epidemiologists. They try to identify patterns of cause of death and then ways of preventing those deaths.
Oh, really? So they're looking at what you'd call metadata then, are they? They're looking at the overall patterns over time.
Yeah, and we don't do that in New South Wales, or at least we do it on an ad hoc basis if people have the time and energy, but we don't have a dedicated research unit, and it would be an enormous improvement to the New South Wales system. And I believe that the government is considering this now. But it would be an enormous improvement of our system if we had a unit like that.
So why aren't they standardised around the country? Well, then again, I suppose you wouldn't get this experimentation like you're seeing in Victoria if they were standardised.
Well, it's the constitution. We're a federation. These are state. Each state has its own coronial system. Each territory has its own system.
The education system's been standardised federally. Yeah,
to a greater or a lesser extent. I think a model act and a model system would be a very good thing, but. What I would really love to see would be all Australian jurisdictions modelling themselves on Victoria.
How is this kind of court viewed in legal circles? Like you said there, when you got appointed to the coroner's court, it was like, oh, strap yourself in, man. This is a bit bleak. This is a bit depressing. Is it commonly seen like that?
Look, I think it's seen like that from the outside. But on the first day in the job, I was in my new office and a barrister friend of mine rang me up and said, mate, you've just landed in the most interesting jurisdiction in New South Wales, and he was right, and it was, and it was one of the best jobs I've ever had in my life. I loved working there.
Does the court treat the death of a very wealthy and powerful person exactly the same way it would for someone like Joyce Germain, for example, or someone who's unknown, who has mental illness, who dies alone, who has no money?
Look, I'd like to think so. But the real difference is that people with the money can afford lawyers, and people who don't have money can be well represented by the Legal Aid Commission or by the Aboriginal Legal Service, for example. But in many, many cases, they don't have legal support. So Professor Ray Watterson, at a conference last week said, you get out of an inquest what you put into it. And I think that's true. So there is an advantage in having money.
What a fascinating tour this has been through what goes on in the coroner's court. Maybe we've been too squeamish in the past to look closely, and there's a whole world in there. It's a revelatory about human nature as well. What a pleasure to speak with you, Hugh. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Richard.
abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.